Welcome to the Weekly Squeak, your weekly geeky squeak with me, as always, Chris Chinchilla. I have a quite interesting interview this week with two of the co-founders from Pixie Labs, a new, a newish contender in the observability for Kubernetes ecosystem. Quite a buzz about them right now. So that interview is coming up very soon, and you can look forward to that. Hope everybody is well. We're in the November gloom here. Let's focus on the cheerful, positive things. I hope any of my listeners and viewers in the States are okay with the results there. I hope those of you who are interested in Apple products are interested in the latest developments there. It's actually something that did appeal to me. I did my first Apple event live tweeting in quite some time. I've been a Mac user for a very long time. So I've been through the 68000 transition, then the PowerPC transition to Intel. So it was interesting to also see a few names like Universal Binaries and Rosetta come back. I'd not seen them for some time. And I just bought I'm gesturing at it here, a new MacBook Pro this year. So slightly annoying, but whatever. I'm actually pretty happy with it. So I'll hold on to it a little bit longer yet, because I think it'll be a little while before I want to switch to a new processor architecture quite anyway. But yep, been an interesting week in technology. I'm going to round up my links first before the interview. Some slightly different things than the Apple event, but I felt like I had to mention it. And yeah, let's get started with my links for the week. So actually, firstly, something from about 18 months ago, actually, from Louis Levere, Immutable Systems. I've been sort of playing around these ideas. I'm obviously a Mac user, so I don't really engage with these Linux systems so much, apart from testing and things like that. But this is operating systems like NixOS. Also, the latest version of Fedora has this concept where an operating system is basically a series of configuration files and can be deleted and recreated very easily. And I guess this takes some borrowing from container models, but takes it to an extreme that your entire machine can just be moved around through a series of configuration files. I think it could only really work with Linux. I don't think it could work with macOS or Windows. Not yet, anyway. Well, I suppose Windows has that concept of, or used to anyway, the sort of network images that that administrators could push out across a network and things like that, but it's not quite the same. So there's an article here that's a little bit of an introduction to the concept. Yeah, here's the Fedora Silverblue. So this is from 18 months ago, but the latest version of Fedora just pushed this out as an option. OpenSUSE has an option. Nitrux. I thought NixOS was part of this. Maybe I was wrong. But yeah, it's an interesting kind of concept. I've been trying to do elements of this with my own kind of setup by having as much as possible in a config file. Homebrew has a function where you can kind of output a lot of your applications as a config file and then use it to restore from that later. There's another command line called macup backup that kind of does a similar thing, but it doesn't cover everything. And then I suppose with things like Creative Cloud and stuff like that, where you can kind of back everything up to the cloud, it's sort of there, but it's really not quite the same. You're relying on various third parties to help you there. But anyway, it's an interesting concept. I would love to hear if anyone runs systems like this on a daily basis. Next, I just realized these tabs are not necessarily in the best order. Linux Mint, another popular Linux distribution, a sort of version of Ubuntu and Debian. Incidentally, I have some interviews with the Ubuntu folks coming up soon. It's a very kind of user-friendly focused Linux distribution. There has been this back and forth between how they package Chromium. They used to use, you can read the article here from Stephen Vaughan Nichols, on ZDNet, they used to use Ubuntu's Chromium build, but then Canonical, and actually I've had previous episodes discussing the Snap Store, moved everything to the Snap Store for a variety of reasons. And there's always been these various competitions to try and make a more universal packaging format for Linux instead of having all the different distribution methods that kind of makes it difficult sometimes for people to create Linux versions of applications because you have to create it for lots of different things. And they took this attitude with Chromium to make it easier to keep up to date with each release. But then the Mint, one of the Mint maintainers, Lefebvre, did not like that method and decided to continue repackaging their own way, the kind of the old way. But that was hard to keep up with. So, and actually they admit sort of defeat here in this paragraph of saying that they don't really like why Canonical did it or the reasons they did it or the reasons they had to do it in some respects. But they kind of agreed that it was potentially the right decision and have sort of switched back to using the Ubuntu shipped version of Chromium. So it's kind of interesting to see how... Sorry, there's a little bit of background noise as I'm talking. It always seems to happen just when I am recording, when I'm streaming. Our local post-delivery person always seems to decide to turn up just when I start their particular stream, which is always great fun. Anyway, I digress. Yeah, so it's interesting to see how this back and forth can happen in Linux, and actually that it happens publicly, so you can kind of always keep up to date with the reasons behind things. Okay, another one from ZDNet, from Daphne Le Prince Ringeur. Try go that pronunciation. This is actually quantum computing. But the reason I like this post and I have highlighted this post is it actually talks about some practical applications of quantum computing. We've been hearing a lot about quantum computing is going to solve this problem and that problem, be great for this and great for that. But it's often been difficult to understand what that's actually going to mean. And there's some interesting examples here in collaboration with D-Wave, who I have interviewed in the past, actually, a little way back from a Mobile World Congress a couple of years ago. Partnerships they had with a couple of companies here, specifically a Canadian grocery chain, this Save-On Foods up here, about what they're actually doing with quantum computing. And that is interesting, and how they're actually solving the problem. And yeah, quantum computers look so cool. It's like something out of Star Trek, this picture here. You'll have to find the article or go to the video version to see that. It's quite fascinating. And yeah, it was just a really interesting post to actually read some practical uses of quantum computing. All right, now let's sort of get into slightly different topics here. This is one from CNET, but was reported in a few different places from Stephen Shankland here, which is a sort of business-to-business mapping company. I actually used to contract to them. They have an office here in Berlin, not too far away from where I am now. And you've probably used their map without realizing a lot. And What Three Words, which I do believe from memory are a British company who I have met as well. I haven't interviewed here either. And they're partnering together to provide What Three Words in car navigation, which is what he predominantly specializes in. And What Three Words is actually divides the world into a lot more sections, shall we say. So you can actually get very specific directions to a very specific part of a building, for example, not just one address for a very large building and then be quite lost once you get there. And so I find this very interesting for What Three Words and for here. Here, and maybe have been struggling in recent years to stay relevant with a plethora of people just using smartphones. And What Three Words have actually been growing. They are the official address system for several small countries, actually. It's quite fascinating. And they've been more and more popular, I think, as people have realized why they're useful. And so to see the combination here and coming into people's cars could be interesting. And also to find out, how people find using it. So it's a small article, but I'd be very interested to see how people like it. And I didn't actually realize this. Google has their own technology here, and there is also, of course, Latitude and Longitude, but What Three Words is quite simple, even though it's sometimes quite comical. And I do remember speaking to them about how they generate these word choices. All right. This is not really something I can describe so much on the audio version if you're listening along, but this is from Amit Katwala on Wired UK. Some amazing photos here of life on board the International Space Station. And it always amazes me because so much is exposed. There's just so many wires and buttons and cables. And also, and I remember there was a British astronaut on a podcast recently, and them describing in theory how old-fashioned the International Space Station is. I mean, it's amazing. It's this thing floating in space, but looking through some of these pictures, you can see that, like, you know, it looks like technology from 10 years ago or so, which it effectively is, and it's expensive to replace. This is kind of cool to see. It looks, this top picture right at the top of the post, it's just like there's so much. I don't understand how he can't be breaking everything all the time. There's just so much stuff and exposed cabling and all sorts of things. Yeah, I think it looks very claustrophobic as well. And this is actually an article from the Telegraph. I need to look behind my camera, clear the cookie notification there. This is from James Titcomb on the Telegraph, but this was widely reported as well, covering how a lot of the campaigning around Proposition 22 happened in the US. It's also one of the votes as part of the recent election. I'm not really going to go into masses of detail on Proposition 22 because it's been covered in many places, and also it's not something that directly affects me, so I'm not massively kind of knowledgeable of the subject. But I think the more interesting angle here was the discussion around should these various applications that are strongly dependent on an app, you know, you use an app to order a car or food or deliveries or whatever, be allowed to just push basically their own propaganda to users all the time. And this is kind of more the discussion. And then where do you stop? I mean, some will quite frequently push out discounts and things like that. Is that okay versus a political message? Where does one begin and one stop? And like, what's the differentiation between a political message kind of and news or an announcement or product announcement or discounts or things like that? So how do you differentiate what they should and shouldn't be able to do with this very large user base they instantly have access to? That's quite a fascinating discussion. I'd love to hear your opinions on it if you're interested in giving me some feedback on that. And finally, I don't know why this keeps popping up in my feed. This is from Ben Sherlock on Screen Rant. I did find it quite interesting to read that many years ago, the Beatles wanted to make a version of Lord of the Rings directed by Stanley Kubrick. And it never happened, of course. But it's been quite interesting reading about what could have happened and the people involved. And yeah, so it was Paul as Frodo, Ringo as Sam, George as Gandalf, and John as Gollum, which is kind of interesting. And the Beatles were somewhat involved in, well, they also had their own films. Also, George Harrison invested in a lot of Monty Python films and various other films as well. Apparently, Stanley Kubrick was not interested at all and turned it down, which is interesting. He had been directing Lolita and Dr. Strangelove at the time. There is a little bit of a strange connection between Peter Sellers and the Beatles via kind of George Martin, their producer. He used to produce a lot of the comedy records Peter Sellers was involved with. The Beatles were going to write the soundtrack, of course. And yeah, sort of people were on board, but it never really happened. In fact, I love this quote. Stanley Kubrick believed the book was unfilmable, which is interesting that Peter Jackson... In fact, it's strange if you look at some of these photos of Stanley Kubrick. Peter Jackson and Stanley Kubrick do share some similar looks as well. So, and also then the Tolkien estate. I think he was still alive at the time. He also didn't want them to do it. So it could have been cool, but it was never going to happen. And then in a nice connection back to our ISS article, he then went on to direct 2001 instead, which was actually a bit trippy in its own right, I suppose. So that was my links for the week. I hope you enjoyed those. And now is my interview with the two co-founders of Pixie.
So I'm the co-founder and CEO of Pixie. Just a quick background about myself before this. Concurrently, I'm also an adjunct professor of computer science at Stanford. And prior to this, I used to be at Benchmark as an EIR. And before that, I was in Google's AI team. And prior to that, I have a whole bunch of experience working on machine learning and data systems. A little bit of background about Pixie. So we started Pixie, Sean and I started Pixie in 2018. And we're primarily focused on building developer tools that allow software engineers to monitor, debug, and troubleshoot their applications that run on Kubernetes clusters without having to modify their source code. With that, Sean, maybe you could do a quick background.
Introduction myself. My name is Ishan Mukherjee. I'm the other co-founder along with Zen and the chief product officer, increasingly focusing on building out the community around Pixie. Prior to us starting the company, I was one of the product heads at Apple for working on Siri, specifically growing out the knowledge graph. And similar to Zen, my background's been in data systems, machine learning, ranging from kind of robotics systems, data systems, machine learning systems, and in both engineering and kind of product capacities. I've been in the industry for the same duration as Zen, about a decade. So excited to talk to you about Pixie.
I had a second question I wanted to ask you, but something that you both said that intrigued me, I think might be worth going down first. So you both come from very strong machine learning AI backgrounds, and I mean traditionally a lot of the platforms that give you insights into Kubernetes clusters are very much sort of static, give you metrics, give you numbers, give you dashboards, et cetera, et cetera. But you both come from this AI machine learning background. So is that something different you're adding? It's not just plain reporting. It's something on top of that? Or is that just your backgrounds? Is there something more you're also doing over a lot of alternative platforms for this?
Yeah, I can add a little bit. And John, feel free to jump in. So on our side, I guess specifically for me, I primarily worked on kind of like two parts of machine learning, right? Like building systems that actually do machine learning at scale. But I've also worked a lot on like actually applying machine learning to systems and trying to optimize systems. So part of what we want to do with Pixie, right? I think the first thing of like the first part of most like machine learning systems is actually getting access to the data. So a lot of what we've been focused on at Pixie is how do we actually make it easy for us to get instant visibility and access to data like right away. And we utilize technologies like eBPF to basically grab like all the raw HTTP, gRPC, along with databases and other calls without actually having to do any work. So one of the things that we established is like just this rich baseline visibility of data without having to modify our applications or relying on like a specific language library to instrument it. Now that we've actually got most of that in place, part of what we're actually looking into and have actually actively built out is, it's a little bit onerous for everyone to go look at every single transaction that's occurred in the machine and try to like understand where the variations are and what the patterns and trends are. So part of what we do right now is on the actual machine that's capturing the requests, we will go and like featureize the requests and be like, okay, does this message have a user ID? And if it does have a user ID, can we like group it into like a specific group of users? And then use that information to generate like profiles and schemas for the messages along with like their performance characteristics. And then we can use that to enable like smarter sampling, right? Because it's like infeasible for us to ship every HTTP request out of the machine because it's just a lot of data. So we're like, okay, what are the most interesting requests for us to save and archive as like exemplars along with all the trends necessary to understand the data? I think part of Pixie's promise is actually to do a lot of this machine learning and hide it, in some ways hide it behind the scenes so we can actually enable the use cases without having to worry too much about what's actually happening from an ML perspective.
Right. Just to add to that, ultimately the way we are modeling machine learning from an end product experience perspective is kind of surfacing features and capabilities which aid the developer's debug workflow, right? So instead of trying to replace them, the idea is like, instead of using 16 steps to debug an incident, what if we exposed features which made it 13 steps, 12 steps, right? So the idea is to augment their workflow versus kind of seeking out the ultimate answer. And I think that will come in generations ahead. But right now, it's extracting features which allow you to facet data products or sample better, as Zen mentioned.
I guess part of the core idea I was going to say is like this idea of like intelligent augmentation, right? Like the goal really is just to like enable developers to work with data more efficiently rather than, you know, give them the answer. Because I think trying to give people the answer on a complex system is going to be very difficult because there's just too many factors that move around and it's hard for us to understand all the details.
And does Pixie go, how far down does it go? Does it also do application level or some I can see Golang logging. Is it some application level or not, or...
Yeah, so there's a bunch of stuff we capture out of the box, right? Which is, which are things like all the system metrics, all the level 7 protocol stuff like HTTP, gRPC, whatever. So we capture all of that like as a baseline and tie it to like a specific service or pod that's running in your system. One of the things we allow you to do is as you're narrowing down where the issue is on certain languages like Go and C++ and Rust, we actually allow you to dynamically add logging. So if an application is already deployed and in the production setting, typically what you would have to do is, you know, go make changes to your source code and then get it reviewed, get it checked in, wait for a deploy to happen, and then hope that the log will give you some useful information. It's pretty typical workflow. One of the things you can do with Pixie is that you can say that go and dynamically add a log to some function in the source code. Or some function in your Go binary, and it will actually automatically add that while the binary is running and then be able to dump out information.
That's pretty clever.
Yeah, so in some ways, you can think about that specific aspect as like trying to do like GDB or something on the fly, but that's like a lot more risky if you have to stop the binary. We use eBPF to actually patch the binary to essentially allow us to intercept the data in the middle, so it actually doesn't stop the
And how does Pixie fit into and compare to some of the other tools you might use to troubleshoot an application on Kubernetes? And they're all slightly different, doing different ways, but there's quite a few options. So what does Pixie give me over a lot of the other options that are currently around?
Yeah, I can take that. So as is pretty consensus, kind of observability space is quite noisy and there's a lot of different tools out there. The way we think about our place in the ecosystem is as an extension to established monitoring platforms. So if you look at the current state, you would have tools like Splunk, New Relic, Datadog, which are essentially your monitoring platforms, which have access to metrics, traces, logs. So the unique value proposition that we deliver is specific to the application developer who traditionally use products like APM, this idea of instant access to live telemetry without any instrumentation. So Pixie focuses on the application developer persona. The product is close to an APM. And the unique value proposition is no instrumentation, live data. We give you access to 24 hours of granular data with historical trends, but that's kind of our wheelhouse. If you want more data for compliance or governance, those are use cases that we currently don't focus on. So if you're a customer, let's just say a gaming company in the UK or a streaming company here in the US, you already have your code base instrumented with custom metrics, piping data into an open source stack like Prometheus or a SaaS product. They install Pixie to basically, kind of as Zen mentioned, give blanket visibility to all workloads working. And then if you're working with Go and C++, give this really novel kind of deep forensic that was pretty impossible to do before. So what we're seeing is Kubernetes platform infrastructure teams is baking Pixie into their platforms by default. It gives them this kind of instant visibility. And then application developers use our UIs, native UIs, to debug, to do live debugging. And if they would like to forward the data into other systems, we expose an API to do so as well. So again, we are an extension to established systems.
And this is kind of good in the long term. It means you don't have to get too bogged down in data storage and things like that.
So, yeah, okay. I think that's an evolution as well. Like, obviously, our near-term focus is on this live data use case. Over time, like, as the developer community kind of looks into looking at cold data or historicals, we will have discussions and kind of going into that. But we're starting off with this kind of essentially live debugging use case.
Yeah. So I'd like to go back a step kind of to the story. So, I mean, Pixie as a company, you said you've been around since 2018, but you kind of were very quiet and then suddenly seemingly appeared out of nowhere in the past couple of months. Seemingly, of course, that's always. And have sort of done reasonably well on funding rounds and things like that. So what's, I mean, let's go back right to the beginning. What was the problem that you were trying to solve when you first started creating Pixie, and why? Like, what gave you the idea in the first place? What gaps did you find that you wanted to fill?
Cool. So I can take a quick stab at it, and Sean, feel free to add more details on your side. So when we were first, I was an EIR at Benchmark, and Sean and I teamed up. When we first started thinking of ideas and started building things out, one of the things I guess I have been pretty spoiled by is just like the infrastructure level support we had at Google, right? Like, when we were building stuff, usually you got lots of visibility and things just happen for you automatically and you don't think too hard about it. Outside, it's a little bit of a different story, right? Like, you have to go add a lot of instrumentation, do a lot of monitoring yourself. So, you know, we had both built at-scale systems, and part of what we wanted to do was actually make monitoring those at-scale systems easy, and make it more, like, you know, magical and automatic. And that's kind of the premise where Pixie started. And originally we were going, you know, hard after, like, okay, let's take a look at BPF and how do we actually build BPF-based collectors. That was, like, an interesting new technology that allowed us to go and access data. And ultimately, you know, we started collecting so much data, we needed to build, like, a different type of system to be able to handle and process it. We managed to be able to create an abstraction layer, which was Pixie Scripts, that basically allowed us to very quickly build out the system and make both the instrumentation and data processing programmatic.
Right. And then just from a timeline perspective, like, since kind of inception, kind of mid, late 2018, last, like, 2019, we kind of focused on building out the platform. This is kind of a reinvention of the entire stack. So there's, like, the collection layer of the cake, the compute lives inside in the cluster, and the UI, as I mentioned, is all API driven. It's an ambitious kind of bet to kind of re-architect kind of the observability stack. So it takes time. So we kind of spent 2019 focus on that. One thing we'd add is that we worked with customers in that process. So we had early customers, and then in May of this year, we started an early access beta. So when the launch happened the first week of October, we had a handful of enterprise paying customers who deployed Pixie at scale in production. They're all paying. And from a community standpoint, we had tens of teams ranging from a Netflix to a Segment, like, in our community. And now that's kind of scaled up to, like, hundreds of teams.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And so you've announced this, where are we? Get the right words. The Pixie community, is that open source? Is that basically just another word for the open source version, or is it something more?
Yeah, I can talk from a packaging standpoint. So Pixie, as it stands today, is a freemium SaaS product. So as we say, like, if you look at Pixie as a three layered cake, our ingesters and our scripts are open source, but the core engine is not open source. We do have plans to kind of probably kind of looking into open sourcing that, but currently it's a freemium SaaS product. And so in terms of what the Pixie community is essentially a free forever offering of that. The idea is for developers across the world, they could essentially deploy Pixie at any scale, whether that's thousands of clusters or a couple of nodes or Minikube, without needing to pay us ever. So what that experience is you can install Pixie in any Kubernetes cluster. You get all of the open source scripts. So you get out of the box value, and essentially you can kind of use Pixie. The paid tiers are mostly priced on the breadth of your deployment and or team specific scripts. So if I am I'm a team, I would like to have team specific scripts. You would have a repository catered for you to create whatever, like Acme org scripts. And for enterprises at certain scale, because we get deployed and kind of hundreds of nodes, kind of thousand node clusters, there are performance, security, and scaling optimization that we worked on that we offer for that.
Yeah. So if I look inside the Pixie GitHub repository, that's basically scripts to kind of bootstrap a Kubernetes cluster somewhere. It's nothing else. There's no runtime or anything like that.
Right, like the Pixel scripts directory there are essentially scripts that we seeded and then the kind of community contributed scripts. So we have a community who we call it Pixie Knots. We do monthly calls, next call is next week. So if a developer, say in Poland, writes a script to debug slow MySQL queries, they can contribute it back so that anybody in the world using Pixie can essentially kind of access that, right? So the idea is to codify debug workflows into these programmatic scripts.
Okay. So these Pixie scripts that you mentioned earlier are individual components for debugging certain things. So I might write one for, well, a bunch of different things, but yeah. Okay, yeah. And they integrate.
So you could either, a lot of times, I think we see Pixie scripts for two different things. One of them is around specific infrastructure components like MySQL or Postgres.
Yeah.
And then if you take a look at some of our customers, they've actually taken some of those scripts and customized it for their own systems.
Okay.
Like they're like, oh, I want to know what the latencies are for my different customer groups.
Okay. And so for a relatively new company, you have good background. You have some good advisors as well. Some relatively well-known names in this kind of, cloud native, large scale computing, whatever we want to call it, ecosystem. What do you think? I don't mean this in a negative way. what did they see in the product that made people want to invest in this reasonably new project?
So I think part of what we have been trying to narrow down at Pixie is just having this focus on like the developer side, which I think is relatively unique across. I mean, it's not, it's still a crowded space, but it's like relatively unique across most observability tools. That our ultimate goal, while we provide like the broad level visibility for SREs, our ultimate goal is to be able to enable software developers to actually debug applications in production. And I think that's been our tight focus from the very beginning. So that's like a big part of it. I think just the idea around this like instant visibility and the ability to create this like community flywheel is like another big aspect of where Pixie is.
Right. I mean, saving developer time and just kind of focusing on ultimately the developer experience that we deliver is the product. The eBPF based collection, the Edge AI ML, and the APIs are the services of delivering that experience where developers can essentially stop worrying about setting up all of these tools and kind of get a seamless experience.
Okay. And I mean, this is always a bit of a big question, especially as you've just sort of released something, but it's a relatively early days. I'm guessing you're moving quite fast. What's on the roadmap for the next 6 months to a year?
Yeah, so I think for us on we're obviously building like crazy still, so that hasn't actually slowed down. In terms of big stuff, we've been focusing a lot on scalability of Pixie on really large clusters. We're deployed on some pretty large production clusters now, but as with most systems, right, it's a work in progress to get it to work at scales of thousands of nodes. So we have some stuff around there. We're working a lot on smarter machine learning and stuff for sampling That's another area. We've been doing a bunch of interesting work on trying to improve and build better tracing within Pixie without actually having to do full span annotation. So that's something you'll probably see coming out in a few months. So those are kind of like the big items, other than like, you know, the standard focus on like improving the out of box experience. And when I say that, I just mean like the immediate usefulness out of the box of Pixie.
Right. I think we think we're kind of just focusing on those will get the kind of community flywheel going and to a path where kind of Pixie is ubiquitous amongst kind of developers building on top of Kubernetes. And that's kind of that bottoms up developer driven growth is what we're focused on.
The one thing I'd certainly like to ask, because I dig around documentation and it's not there right now, but your main kind of contributor workflow is for these scripts. What's your recommended pathway at the moment if someone is interested in writing, contributing one of those Pixie scripts? It looks like at the moment it's mostly have a look at an example and try and figure it out. But is there a right. recommended path for you?
Yeah, I think that's good feedback as well. Like you're working on a lot of new learning content to kind of absolutely like lower the learn kind of help people along the learning curve to write and contribute kind of Pixel scripts. As of right now, I think the GitHub repo has a README file which describes it, and then documentation we have exemplar kind of tutorials. But like we're coming very soon. Our folks are working on kind of more learning content that'll come through. The best resource right now, being an early stage company, is for interested developers and operators to become part of our community. So we build and kind of iterate out in the open. So we have a Slack group called the Pixie Nerd Community. We meet once a month on calls, and that's how we iterate fast. But your points were well noted that we need more kind of knowledge content, and that should be coming soon.
Okay, cool. All right. Interesting. I have another live stream I do where I actually like try developer tools as well. So I'll add this to the list. I like to try and time the stream and the podcast reasonably close to each other so they can kind of fit together. Can you run it on a local machine and get some meaningful metrics or not really, do you think?
By local machine, do you mean not Kubernetes, or you mean like Minikube?
Well, like a Minikube or something like that.
Yeah, you can. But usually I think to run like most of the meaningful demo applications.
Yeah, well, of course.
Probably have a larger cluster.
It's always the problem with large scale stuff. Like testing it is always a pain because it's like, yeah, to have this quick test, rig up a cluster with all this gigabytes of data storage and all this memory, and this is like, I just want to test it, you know. But at the same time, you don't need it for anything that low scale either. So it's kind of hard to know sometimes. But yeah. All right. Cool. Okay. Well, good luck with everything. And when do you think the sort of public beta will? Have you got a vague timeline for when the public beta will be over? Or
I think when roughly, you get enough feedback, roughly we're planning kind of Q1, Q2, kind of next year. So early next year, you should hear from us. I think because we ran the early access kind of private beta, and then with the public beta. The feedback's been pretty amazing. It's mostly around kind of building out the features around the paid products and stuff. So and getting the community to a critical mass. We should launch that early next year.
That was my interview with the co-founders of Pixie. Hope you enjoyed that. Now, a few small updates from me. I have been very busy the past few weeks taking part in NaNoWriMo. I actually have a daily. Not today, I had to cancel it, the day of recording, because I had to cancel it. Sometimes just work things get in the way. But I'm basically doing pretty much a daily stream where you can watch me write. I don't know how interesting it is. And I listen to music, which has meant that all my videos have been defunded by YouTube and Facebook. But fine. It doesn't really matter. I wasn't really looking to get those videos ad ready anyway. So doing daily sessions are usually around 11 a.m. Central European time every day. I may change some of those times later. And yeah, you can watch me write. I looked on Dexpose last week at builder plugins with Netlify, which is quite interesting. I am about to record a new solo adventure this week, part two of Creatures Such As We. We also just finished recording episode 4 of Stories About People, and episode 3 should be released in the next week or so. Likewise, episode 3 of Board Game Jerk, so that's coming out soon. You can also watch my video. Actually, my site needs some slight updating. I recently put out a special sponsored video with What's New in Snagit 2021. You can find that on my YouTube and Twitch feed for Dexpose at the moment, but I'll get it on the website soon. I feel like there's something else. Oh, yeah, I'm back doing the Crit Test Dummies on Twitch. Dungeons & Dragons live stream, so you can also watch that. What else? I'm nearly finished with some blog posts, a whole bunch of other things, recordings for some videos, lots of things in preparation. But NaNoWriMo is taking up a lot of my time at the moment. So head on over to christianschiller.com to keep up to date with what I'm up to get in touch, to support what I do. Always appreciated. And if you enjoyed the show, please rate, review, share, give me feedback to any of my various outlets where you can find me. And yeah, I hope you enjoyed the show. And until next time, thank you for joining me.